And on this morning's newsmaker, it's a one-hour newsmaker. We'll talk politics with Dr. Ostrower after the 8:30 news. Right now, though, we have Dr. Ostrower on the line with a longtime friend of his, 1963 Alfred University graduate, a songwriter who spent a lot of time in Nashville, and the author of 20 books, welcoming now Michael Kosser to our lines. Thank you for calling in.
Thanks, Brian. How are you?
Doing well, and I want to thank you so much, and I want to thank Dr. Ostrower for helping line this up.
I hope it works.
I wanted to list off some of the songs that Michael Kosser's written. George Jones, You Always Look Your Best, Louise Mandrell, Put It On For Me, Louise Mandrell, Begging For Mercy. The list goes on and on, and like we said, he's written 20 books besides this. Today we're going to focus on a book that he wrote some years ago, How Nashville Became Music City, USA, 50 Years of Music Row. Michael, first off, I'd be remiss if I did not mention Charlie Pride, who died over the weekend. Your thoughts on Charlie Pride?
Oh, he was special. He just came in where nobody else was, and it didn't take very long at all. He just had a combination of musical talent and personality that got everybody excited. Even he could come before an audience in Mississippi that had never seen a black singer sing country before, and he put him on his side in no time flat. He was an amazing man.
Michael Kosser, in today's music world, I'm sure this isn't true universally, but some, I don't want to say a lot necessarily, but some of your stars are like Kelly Clarkson, and they make it big from going on TV talent shows. Kelly Clarkson was on American Idol, as I'm sure you both know. What's the difference between 2020 and 1979? I don't remember any show, at least a lot of shows, or a whole lot of talent shows in 1979. I'm trying to think of, I don't know. I can't think of any. Michael Kosser, what the difference between then and now?
Well, they didn't have talent shows showing who would be the next star necessarily. But if you look back, even into the 1940s and 50s, you know, where you had Arthur Godfrey and shows like that on radio, they would bring in amateur talent or talent that people hadn't heard of, and they might become successful as a result of being on the radio show.
I guess that even that concept goes back to what, the 1930s, and there was a guy, I know this because I worked at WLEA since grade school. Don't tell the State Labor Board that, eighth grade to be exact, but we used to play old radio shows, and there was a show named Major Bowes. Maybe Dr. Ostrower remembers that?
I can't say that I remember that.
There was a show called Major Bowes, and he used to have a talent show. Anyways, what you're saying, Michael Kosser, is that the whole idea of The Voice and American Idol, it's something that they've revamped from decades ago.
I believe so. There's nothing new under the sun, and I'm sure somebody thought about that. I think along the way there've always been some. The whole idea with those shows was to make them into big super TV shows that would get millions of people watching, and they've been extremely successful at it.
And you point out the difference between those shows of the old days. They were looking for fans for that particular show, and today they're trying to create new stars overnight.
I think so. I don't know what they were trying to do at the beginning, but that's the way it is today, and it sure does work. And sometimes you hear some amazing things on the and they, you know, they send people out to look for this talent, and so they find it.
If I could ask one question, and I know Dr. Osterhout wants to ask some questions, Michael Kosser, how did you write your songs? Did you wake up in the morning, like Paul McCartney talks about the song Yesterday, just suddenly occurring to him? Do you have a method as to how that happens, that you write a song?
Oh, no. You know, I always say anything that gets you started. So, for example, you know, in the old days, the days of the old pop music, pre-rock and roll pop music, this guy wrote the melody and that guy wrote the lyrics, okay? So Richard Rodgers was a melody writer. Oscar Hammerstein was a lyric writer. Today in many of your music fields, certainly in country, a couple of writers sit down, or in this day and age, and this is a whole different story, sometimes you'll find four, five, six people on a song, which, you know, well, we won't talk any further about that, but...
what do you think? Well, if I could stop you there, Michael Kosser, what do you make of these sorts of collaborations where there's lots of, I mean, in some cases, it's a lot of singers. You might have four or five big singers on a song. What do you make of four or five songwriters? How does that affect the music, if I could ask it that way?
Well, okay. When you look at that four or five songwriters and you look a little bit more closely, one of them might have been the producer on the record, one of them might have been somebody else who has something to do with it. Everybody wants to get involved, because two or three people can do a song just fine, and in fact, one person can write a great song. Doesn't take five or six. You know, usually the artist is on the song, and how much work he did on it. Generally, if he did that much on it, he probably, you know, it's probably one or two people. When you see five or six people on a song and one of them's a songwriter, one of them is the artist, there's a chance that he was in and out, and he says, yeah, I like that a lot. What about this? And, how much of it, you know, it varies. Five or six people, or sometimes even more. I don't know. A lot of it has to do with, are you part of that company?
Right. We're speaking this morning in this segment of Newsmaker with Michael Kosser, a songwriter and author of almost two dozen books. Dr. Gary Osterhout is also on the line with us. Gary, you have a question.
Yeah, I have about two or three questions. One of them is related in a sense to something that Brian asked before, the 1970s versus songwriting today. To what extent, how can you compare the two? I mean, is today songwriting really a corporate enterprise in contrast, let's say, to the 1970s when it was an individual enterprise done by one or two or three people who simply had a lot of talent and a lot of energy? Can you compare these, you know, to this industry over 50 years?
Well, I think you just did, Gary, and you did a good job. In those days, back in the here's something interesting. And back in the 70s, when I came to town, very often the artists were looking for songs. They did not write their own. There were a few who did. Merle Haggard did. Johnny Cash wrote some of his own. Not most of them. A person could come to town, come to Nashville, and want to be strictly a songwriter, and he gets involved with a publishing company, and the publishing company pitches that person's songs, and if that person's songs are really, really good, or that person is really, really lucky, he'll get some, he or she will get some cuts. Nowadays, as the 70s moved into the 80s and the 80s into the 90s, so forth and so on, more and more it became corporate. It became, you know, who can you couple with? Who can you, you know, find who loves your songs and go on from there? Became more corporate. Let's put it that way. And in the 70s and 60s, it was much more talent oriented, I think.
You've written a lot of songs, and you've written songs for singers who we are, you know, quite familiar with, you know, Conway Twitty and the Mandrell Sisters and so forth. Of all these major artists, which one did you find it, in a sense, most comfortable to work with? Which one did you most enjoy working with?
Well, that's an interesting thing, because normally you didn't work with them. You took your song to the song plugger at your company. And if he or she really liked the song, they start pitching it. And the more pitches you do, the more likely you are that somebody's going to like it. And so the artists, I never knew any of them until after the songs were recorded. There might be some. No, there's probably an exception or two, like a father daughter team called the Kendalls that I had a big hit on. But mostly I didn't know him until after. Now, Barbara Mandrell, she had my first hit, and I never really, well, I got to talk to her once or twice, but mostly her father and I became really good friends. He was a former policeman from Corpus Christi, Texas, and somehow or other, we hit it off real well, and I miss him to this day.
Oh, and Dr. Ostro has another question. I did want to pop in with one quick question as a follow-up before. And sorry, Gary, I'm only doing this before I forget. You mentioned how music is getting more corporate. I think that's true for a lot of the world. I think when some people hear that phrase, things are getting more corporate, they think things are getting a little bit more uptight. There's a lot more rules and regulations. People maybe, could I go as far as to say, are snitching on each other? What do you mean by the word corporate, Michael Kosser?
Okay, let me see if I make a fool of myself out of this. what it really is people in high places get to feel like they know what they're doing. They know how they know how it works, and to a certain degree, they're right. But that doesn't make it better. That very often makes it worse. For example, in the old days, if I can say in the old days, the record companies would send their music to the radio stations, and sometimes the radio station, the program director or music director would decide based on the prominence of the artist or how he or she liked the songs, they'll go on it right away. Other times, and this used to happen, and this was great, they didn't necessarily want to play it, but the fans out there who listened to the radio, they heard the song once and they'd start requesting it. And many, many songs became hits because they got a tremendous amount of requests from listeners. Today, I think the radio, for example, most radio stations today of any size are owned by just a few radio companies. And that's never good. As far as I'm concerned, they have one person maybe selecting the music for all of their stations to some degree. So in the old days, you'd have certain radio stations that were good at going on a new record with a new artist that nobody ever heard of, and other stations waited until the song became big, and they don't have much of that anymore.
He's Gary. I can only say Michael Kosser, in from what I've talked about in my much smaller and more limited experience than Michael's, he's 100% right, Gary.
Well, I want to ask you a question then, which is not just about, you know, radio and music per se, but specifically about something that you've written about. You've written a terrific book called How Nashville Became Music City, USA. And I can tell you I probably have learned more about country music by reading that book, which is filled with really good stories and really good interviews about, you know, people that most of us would recognize if we ever listened to country music. Why Nashville? Why not L.A.? Why not New York? Why not Detroit? There are plenty of centers out there. Why Nashville, of all places, a medium-sized city in an out-of-the-way place?
Well, of course, L.A. and New York were and are, especially L.A., music centers. You know, when we were kids, New York was a big deal. But around the mid-60s or so, for some reason or other, the industry began to move to L.A., and New York lost an awful lot of its participation in popular music. There are other places like Memphis, for example, Atlanta, even Boston. You could name, Detroit, of course, dozens of places around the country that were at one time or another it looked like they were going to happen. But I think one of the big reasons was the people who basically were the founders of Music Row, the place where the songs are recorded and so forth. They had a very open mind. They didn't try and people like Owen Bradley and Chet Atkins. Owen Bradley ran Decca Records and Chet Atkins ran RCA. They didn't try and keep it all for themselves. When new publishing companies came to town and they met these people who were, you know, were talented and interested and excited about the business, they could go into their offices and play songs for them, and Chet was always open for them, and Owen was always open for them, and whereas other towns I won't necessarily name, they had one or two companies that did well, and those companies tried very hard to keep the business for themselves. At least that's the impression that I have.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Gary Ostrower and his friend Michael Kosser. Michael Kosser, a major songwriter out of Nashville and a 1963 graduate of Alfred University. Stay with us.
The angel said to them, "Do not be afraid, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which will be to all people. For there is born to you this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men." Merry Christmas from the Ryan Agency.
When COVID hit, we wore our masks and kept our distance, and our numbers stayed low. Now it's tempting to relax, especially in small groups, but we can't let our guard down. Keep wearing those masks. Stay 6 feet apart. Don't forget to wash your hands and avoid gatherings as much as you can. We'll get through this, but for now, let's stay strong to stay safe. You are medicine, medicine of the highest order.
We're back here on Newsmaker, 1 Hour Newsmaker Show today, and we're on with Michael Kosser. He's an author and a Nashville songwriter. He's worked with a lot of big stars, Conway Twitty, The Mandrells, George Jones, Charlie Rich. The list goes on and on. Dr. Ostrower, you had a question you wanted to get to before the break.
Yeah, and it goes back in a sense to this issue of, you know, what was it like back then in the 1970s versus what it's like today. Would it be fair to say that that the music industry, such as it was a lot more of a community, much more of a cooperative enterprise rather than a very competitive enterprise? Or was there a huge amount of competition from the beginning?
I can only speak for Nashville. Okay, I've never been part of any other music scene, and the Nashville, especially then, you know, there was definitely an all for one, one for all feeling. When back in the '60s, when the British invasion came in, there was one Nashville act that came along and resisted all that, and it was no problem at all for that person, and it'd be hard for you to figure it out, so I'll tell you, and that was Roger Miller. Everybody in Nashville was absolutely thrilled for Roger Miller, or so I'm told. I wasn't here at the time, but the general feeling was what's good for one is good for the rest of us too, and they never felt like at that time. They never felt like that guy's taking my place at the table, okay? But many years later, there became a little bit more jealousy, a little bit more fear that, oh, this guy's getting it all. For example, when Garth Brooks came along, right at the beginning, there were people who were saying, you know, what's this thing with Garth Brooks? What's he got? Well, he had it all. And it took a little while for them to feel good about Garth.
Well, then let me put you on the spot in a sense. You know a lot about country music. If you had to select the two or three most important country songs that we have, you know, had in the last 50 or even 60 years, what would they be?
Oh, goodness. Gary, I hate that you asked me that. I don't know, because if I say this song, it's the song that happened to pop into my mind at the time, and then I'll say, no, that's ridiculous. Okay, here's one I can give you. I say to people, what is the most important song in the history of country music? And let's see if I can think of the title. Do you have an idea? Do either of you have an idea on the subject?
Oh, gosh. Kenny Rogers, The Gambler.
Okay, Gary.
Lisa Brewer, Put Another Nickel In.
As a country act?
Well, go ahead. Tell us who it is.
Hank Williams' first major hit, Lovesick Blues. Now, he didn't write this song. This song was written by two Broadway songwriters. Irving Mills was one. They wrote the song back around 1920 or something like that, maybe even before that. But Hank Williams, first of all, there was another artist who cut it, a country artist who cut it, and became somewhat of a hit in the 30s. But Hank, when he was playing out, he'd sing that song and with that little yodel in it, and the fans would go absolutely wild. And he demanded that Fred Rose, his producer and publisher, allow him to cut the song. And the reason that song is so important, I think it's fair to say that Hank Williams, from a standpoint of sales and appearances and all the rest, was the first country super-duper star. And that was the song that made Hank Williams a superstar.
How important was Heartbreak Hotel to the history of music in Nashville?
Ah! Okay, everybody. Heartbreak Hotel, as everybody knows, is the song that made Elvis a superstar. Okay? Elvis was a... was recording in Memphis for Sun Records, and RCA decided to sign him. A friend of mine, he found Elvis, in the South, and he was doing very well as a regional act. And he went to RCA. So you have to sign this guy. And they did. And Heartbreak Hotel was a song written by a woman named Mae Axton, who was the mother of Hoyt Axton. Mae Axton and a guy named Tommy Durden wrote the song. I brought it to a guy named Buddy Killen, who was looking for, he was working for a publishing company called Tree, and he was looking for songs. May pitched it to Elvis, and according to my book, which is because it's in my book, it's got to be true, Elvis said, "Hot dang, May, play it again." That's what made Elvis a superstar. So Heartbreak Hotel was a terribly, terribly important song in rock and roll history.
Well, thank you so much. It was a thrill speaking with you this morning, Michael Kosser.
Thanks, Brian.
And thank you, Dr. Ostrower.
Hey, thanks for having both of us on.
Dr. Ostrower will be back in just a moment with a political commentary on this one-hour newsmaker.